Thank you for downloading the Turner Talks program. Turner Talk webinar programs are aired on Tuesdays at noon Central Time. To join a noon Turner Talk webinar, go to rad-cast.com. Programs are eligible for CE credits towards your licensure. CE credits will be awarded to individuals who have opted to redeem course credits via the a la carte option or the RadCast All Access Pass subscription and have completed the program post-test with a passing score. Just as a reminder, track all of your CE credits with the CE wallet on RadCast.com. Here, we'll help you track your credits that you've completed on RadCast and from other providers as well. Have a topic you'd like to see us do our show? Send an email to client.support@radcast.com and let us know what your ideas are because we want to be your education partner. So today on Turner Talk, we have two guests and we are talking to Dr. Richard Fleming and to Dusty York. So these are my Nuke Med friends from that side and we're going to fuse all of our imaging modalities together here. And Dr. Fleming's going to tell us, one, I want to say Dr. Fleming has an extraordinary career. He is very well published, very well spoken and presented, and has been on 2020. His research and theories and he's been on the TV show 2020. Dusty is also very well researched and presented. She travels internationally to work on educational programs, but I'm going to let each of them give you a little bit of bio, a little background on themselves. So Dr. Fleming, if you want to start, just tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the program.
Well, I am a physicist, physician, slash attorney, kind of the process there. I'm somebody who was raised in the 1960s. I am, as some people may know, what we call a Kennedy kid. That was somebody that was dumb enough to get picked out by the government during our younger years and placed into some advanced programs, which I benefited from the physics point of view. So my area in physics is particle physics. And eventually I ended up going to medical school at the University of Iowa, which I'd like to comment positively on. It's the largest university hospital in the United States, and it was something that I didn't realize at the time, is the only university hospital that does not have private practice physicians. So I was trained in a very academic, research-oriented perspective. And the second thing that our dean told us was that 90% of what we would be taught was wrong. And he encouraged those of us who are research-oriented to go out and investigate that. So I've spent literally decades of my life investigating how we diagnose disease, both in cardiovascular disease and in oncology. And then, as some people may know, I joined American Heart way back when it was still in blackboard stages and was on the physician cholesterol education faculty, rose up through the ranks, became responsible for being one of the reviewers for American Heart, helped to write some of the guidelines for lipids and heart disease, and then evolved that into the theory of inflammation and heart disease, which, believe it or not, all actually ties together because the simultaneous investigation of how we look for disease and what causes it opened a number of mistakes that were present and has made it possible to now develop quantification methods, which hopefully we'll talk about a little bit today.
All right, Dusty.
Okay, well, mine's not quite as lengthy. I'm a nuclear medicine technologist by trade. I have been an educator for the past 17 years at Chattanooga State Community College in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I currently serve on the board for the Society of Nuclear Medicine as a director at large, and I'm very involved with other organizations in nuclear medicine as well.
So I'm going to say to start off, full disclosure here, Dusty and I have already done a podcast interview with Dr. Fleming. So we kind of have a head start on this topic, but it is so broad and so deep that I think we've got more than enough to talk about here. And I will say when I very first scheduled the podcast interview with Dr. Fleming, I was going to go solo. And I was so fortunate to be with Dusty at the same time. And I thought, hey, Dusty, this is your topic. So why don't you hop in on the nuke med side of it? So I'm going to say for all my radiation therapists out there, for any other imaging sciences, You will gain so much from this topic, but having the NucMed perspective on here really just adds to it in a way that I couldn't. So I am so happy, one, to have Dr. Fleming on part of this show, and to have Dusty helping out again. Thanks a lot, Dusty. So Dr. Fleming, let's really just go over your quantification kind of idea and theory and that whole process that you've got, because from a radiation therapist perspective or a mammographer, so I'm going to trend more towards the oncology applications, but I really do want to hear all about the cardiac applications as well. But as a therapist, like I said, mammographer, radiographer, we know that when we look at films, like you say, that's more of a qualitative reading of a film. And so you say it's very important to be able to quantify these results so that we have a better trend toward disease or towards treatment or treatment tracking. So why don't you talk a little bit maybe about that the qualitative versus the quantitative.
Right. Thank you. And, you know, that's very critical. And before I do anything else, thank you for the invitation to appear here, for both of you ladies being here. It's a great opportunity for me to talk about this and present it to people who know it. Many people are very much aware that we've been doing nuclear imaging or we do other types of imaging, and physicians like myself interpret the results. That's qualitative imaging. What do I see? And there's a huge difference between what I see or what you see or what Dusty would see if you would look at an image. And it has nothing to do with degrees or anything else. It just has to do with human eyes interpreting what they think they're looking at. A classic example, I remember in medical school, we were taught that if one of our classmates who was a woman came up to us and said, you know, that person's eyes over there, they're yellow. They have jaundice. We were told we probably should pay attention to that, even if we didn't see the yellow in the sclera, because for some reason, women tend to see that yellow discoloration better than men. So that's just one of the unique differences. And where I trained at UT in Houston, shout out to them, where we also had a PET camera, we would routinely go in and talk to physicians and say, if you look at that image, if you look at that PET scan, there's disease right here. And we would have people coming from all over the country and the world, and they would look at us and just say, I don't see it. And we would just have to scratch our heads and go, it's right there. You know, you can see it. And, you know, the fact that I'm not bald is a testament to the fact that I just kind of acquiesce to the fact that different people see different things. And so that's really undependable, even though the nuclear imaging itself is very, very good. It's the only method that allows us to tell the function of something. Our dependence upon do you see something is very limited. That's a light switch on-off phenomenon. Yes, you have a problem. No, you don't. Nuclear is so much more sophisticated than that, and we've not taken advantage of the ability of our planar cameras, our SPECT cameras, our PET cameras, even our handheld probes when we go in the operating room, to quantify and tell us what's really there. So the images that we have been looking at are rough estimates from the machine that says, well, the human says, this is the color image or the black and white they want to see. And then the human gets to interpret. And the consequence of qualitative imaging or qualitative results is that we have problems with sensitivity, the ability to find disease when it's there, and specificity, the ability to correctly tell somebody they don't have a problem when they don't. Those same machines, when asked to measure something, are quite able to tell us what is coming from the patient, the emissions. So the E that we have in SPECT and the E that we have in PET, that's emissions. And so nuclear cameras measure emissions or scintillations, and that's all they measure. They don't measure volumes. They don't measure lengths. So SUV, as an example, is at best a semi-quantitative approach, but it's not a quantitative approach because our cameras don't measure weight. They don't measure volume. They do measure scintillation. So the process, remember I told you that, you know, our dean told us that 90% of what we learned would be wrong, was very applicable here, that we're using nuclear cameras right now that have never been quantitatively calibrated. And by quantitative, I mean, if we ask the camera to count, how do we know it's accurate? Just because it gives us a number. And so the first part of this patent was to develop a method to know whether the number the camera was giving us was an accurate count. Maybe the camera's missing information. And that turns out that the more we try to tweak the camera so it appears more visually appealing so we can qualitatively interpret, it turns out that that same process results in the camera losing information. And so the patent is a multi-step process. It's first developing a system where we say, what are we looking for? Are we looking for heart disease? Are we looking for breast cancer? Are we looking for something else? What are we using to look for that? Are we using technetium? Are we using thallium? Are we using ammonia, FDG, rubidium 82, you name it? And which camera then is applicable? And then what is the time sequence for looking for that? And what we want to know, what the patent does is it determines a method for saying, okay, let's look and calibrate the camera quantitatively on both ends of the time that we would be looking for the problem, let's say breast cancer, so that we know that when the numbers come out of the computer, out of the camera, that those are accurate depictions of what's going on. And once we've calibrated that, then we can depend upon the camera to tell us exactly what's happening. And because of this new approach, we've been able to see the redistribution of isotopes that we had been told don't redistribute. We've been able to see how it changes in tissue. And the key thing is that both cancer and heart disease is really the result of being able to measure two phenomena. One, changes in regional blood flow, and two, differences in metabolism. So that part of what we do with this patent is we enhance the differences between different types of tissue, whether that be cancer or inflammatory changes, or for heart disease, Dusty, differences in ischemia and levels of ischemia. And then that information can actually then be plugged into a quadratic equation, which translates washout or wash-in changes, 2% diameter stenosis for heart disease, to flow reserve as it truly exists. Many of the equations that are currently used that people think about, Dusty, Deer and flow reserve, are what was done by Gould, the guy who trained me. But unfortunately, those equations are dog equations. And it turns out that the flow reserve for dogs and the flow reserve for people are different. And anybody in the field who's bothered to look at the work of the last 100 years would know that, because the surgeons in the 1930s showed that the flow reserve of dogs and humans and baboons and every species is different. So you can't use what Gould had developed unless you're looking at dogs. And we do dog research, and that's very applicable. When I'm looking at a human being, it has absolutely no bearing on what your flow reserve is. And so even the equations that we talk about that are semi-quantitative in nuclear imaging for the heart for people are off, because they're using the wrong equation. And the equations are part of the proprietary data for the patent. And in fact, I frequently get this at conferences where somebody will come up to me and they'll say, well, Dr. Fleming, what's the proprietary equations? And I will go, you know what they are? And they'll go, what? And I'll say, they're proprietary, which means I'm not going to tell you. Anyway, okay, so hopefully that, and because we can measure exactly where you are, the people who first grasp on the importance of this quantification recognize something almost immediately, which is, when we want to know if a treatment is working for somebody, how do you do that? Well, qualitatively, you're guessing. And that's why in cancer, we have terms like five-year survival. That doesn't mean you're cancer-free. It means you're not dead. That's all that means. When by quantification, we can actually tell you whether a treatment is having any impact for breast cancer or heart disease or anything else, because we can measure its effect right after giving it, which means we're saving time, money, and lives. Because if your treatment's working, let's go to cancer again. Let's say your chemotherapy is working. I'm a firm believer that most people will say, you know, I'll take the toxic side effects. I'll take the nausea. I'll take the hair loss. I have personal connections with this. Not myself, but people close to me that will say, you know, I'll do that if the cancer treatment's working. But if you're getting a treatment and it's not working and you can measure that, it's not time to give you 5 more months of that treatment. It's time to switch to a different treatment. And the same thing's true for heart disease, whether it's the statin medications or anything else. You know, one of the other theories that I came up with was inflammation and heart disease, and that's actually my theory. And it explains all the different components of what causes heart disease. It's not just cholesterol. It's an inflammatory process. So by giving you a treatment and seeing your cholesterol level go down, it does not mean that we have successfully treated your heart disease, because one of the papers we published in 2008 showed that if you measure changes in blood tests like cholesterol and lipoprotein little a and C-reactive protein, the changes in those blood tests do not match the changes in the nuclear images that show heart disease. And so we can't depend upon an indirect measure like a blood test. We need to actually be measuring heart disease. And I promised earlier in the pre-taping conversations that, you know, red meat has now come into a hot topping in the Annals of Internal Medicine earlier this month in October. And, you know, I've commented on that we don't know what these diets do to people, because we don't have any studies measuring the effect on the heart or on cancer, because we've never quantified anything for these. So we're telling people these diets are okay, these diets aren't okay, these drugs are okay, these drugs aren't okay. The truth is we don't know, because we have not done the study, and that's we're gearing up to do those types of studies. Okay, that's the umbrella.
I am going to, in a little bit, I want to refer back to, because you sent me an article that I read and studied a little bit about the 5-year survival rates. But I think this is a good time right now for you and Dusty maybe to talk about the cameras, how that quantification process kind of works. I know y'all kind of got into some QA a little bit during the podcast. So I think that let's set the foundation for how this stuff gets done, and then we'll go into, you know, what the results are and how it really works when it comes to diagnosis and treatment.
Sounds good. I'm curious to hear from Dusty.
One of my questions was, because I think we previously mentioned this, was a lot of this is incorporated in the quality control setup of the camera, correct?
The visual image as we see it is already set up in qualitative control. That's why you call it qualitative control. But you don't call it quantitative control, because you've not been doing quantitative controls. And if anybody can appreciate how these cameras, all the effort it takes for the images to look good, it's the nuclear techs, because it's all of you that are doing this day in and day out. When I started as a cardiology fellow in Houston, I started out thinking I was going to do cardiac catheterization all of my life, but it turned out that we had nuclear studies that were going on. I learned more on nuclear cardiology from my nuclear technologists than I ever did my attendings. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do a shout out to Julio Rodriguez Bird, who was the nuclear tech. And Julio discovered that the quality control for one of the isotopes, these new technetium isotopes, are all research experimental when I came through. So I got to do the first research work with them and the first papers. Julio discovered that the QA strip was actually flipped upside down, and the results were all wrong. And it was Julio who brought it to my attention, who I then took it back to the company. And despite all the brand name nuclear cardiologists that were already on the project, none of them had discovered what Julio had found.
Now, as far as the information being able to be used on multiple devices. So you said it can be used on SPECT cameras, it can be used on PET cameras.
Yes.
Because we use PET a lot for treatment follow-up.
Right. Right.
And so I think there could be a great application of this, especially in PET, since we deal with so many oncology patients. So do you actively have this in place in some facilities on PET cameras?
We have three universities right now that we are setting it up both for SPECT and for PET. I'm the weird duck in nuclear cardiology, I think, because when I came through, not only did I learn SPECT, but I was one of the three that were trained by Gould on PET. So there was Schneider, Yoshida, and myself. And we spent a full year training on PET imaging. So, you know, here's my pitch. Everybody in nuclear who's going either SPECT or PET, please quit doing that. They are both important. We're doing only damage to ourselves and the field. They are both extremely important modalities for imaging. And just on the record, I love PET. You know, you can't spend a year being trained in PET and what it can do and not appreciate the value of PET. So yes, all three universities that I'm working with have asked for it because, and we mentioned this in the audio conversation that we had before in the podcast before, this patent was developed by combining what we were doing at the same time with heart images and breast cancer imaging. So the acquisition of both sets of images occur simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so when this comes out, as I'm teaching people one step and then the other, the full development of FMT-VDM it will be a total body image acquisition simultaneously looking at heart disease and cancers in the same patient with a single injected dose of radioactive isotope. That's the ability that nuclear has. And with PET, FDG, ammonia imaging, rubidium-82, whatever you're using, all extremely applicable to not only the diagnostic quantification, but the treatment follow-up. And yes, you're right on target. PET will, with this patent, have a huge potential to determine treatment outcome success and change the way we do medicine, because the way we do medicine now, because we don't have any quantitative studies to show what's going on, we use these end results. We use guesstimates like changes in blood cholesterol or guesstimates because you're still alive at 5 years to determine whether treatments probably or probably don't work. And then we come up with percentages. Well, if you're the patient, you don't want to know. It's okay if you've got arthritis and your joints hurt and you take a non-steroidal and it doesn't do it, you switch to another non-steroidal. It's not life-threatening to you, right? But you want to know if you're the patient what these do. So this allows us to tailor treatment to the patient, very specific. And that not only demonstrates itself as improved outcomes for the patient, but it also demonstrates reduced cost because we're not wasting time giving medicines that aren't working for you. They might work for the next person, but they're not working for you. So healthcare costs will be brought down because we will be tailoring your treatment based upon your response, not my response or the next 20 people in line's response, but your very specific response, which means that when physicians look at their patients and they say, Mrs. Jones or Mr. Jones, your treatment is working. We know it's working. And that's a different level of confidence that you can give to the patient and the patients can have. You know, it's right across the board. If it doesn't work, you want to be able to come back to Mrs. Jones or Mr. Jones and say, okay, this did not work. We're not wasting another month of your life. There are other treatments available. Let's do this.
I think this is very exciting for nuclear because I was raised in that and went through training during that phase of unclear medicine. You know, that's what medicine is. So I think adding the quantitative information is just very exciting. I think, you know, and also in the research on breast imaging, you know, it being, you know, much more, you know, quality on dense breast or patients who have breast implants, because the information we were able to gather from those patients was very limited. And like you said, more of a guess. So I think this definitely has some application there as well.
Oh, definitely. And this quantifies it. So we're able to see the differences. And what I've done now is I've coined a new term called the health spectrum. We're supposedly in health care, right? We're not in disease care. We treat everything like it's disease. And we're in health care. Our responsibility is to provide health care to the patient. So we have, I've changed this to a health spectrum that you can measure where somebody sits from one end of the spectrum with in breast cancer, normal breast tissue, to there are changes as it transitions from normal breast tissue to inflammatory changes, to transitional changes of early cancers to cancers. The numbers change. And one of the things that I've mentioned, I think to Cheryl, is that we have a paper we've just submitted where we took a recent center. You asked about centers where we have been looking at this. We recently allowed a physician who's a cardiologist to do these breast cancer tests just to see if somebody who does nothing with breast cancer can actually get the quantitative results. And where I'd love to say that the images look as pretty with what he's done, they don't. He's not nearly as good at it. The numbers are spot on. And in fact, there was so much information that we got out of this that we can show the changes in this data, and hence it's been submitted. We can show the changes in tissue growth rates as it transitions from normal through inflammatory changes to precancers to cancers. You can mark the changes in the growth rates of the tissue as they become cancers, and you can also show where the cancers start to slow down their growth rates, which is just fascinating. It means that all the stuff that they speculated about 50 and 100 years ago were right. They're spot on. I mean, they didn't have the ability to do it. So this quantification places you like a rheostat. Instead of an on-off switch, it tells you where you are. It dials you in to where the person is. So there's no more this simple, you have cancer, you don't. The point is you have this value. And this value tells you where you're at on this transition. Much more key. What is the level of your health? Where are you headed? And what can we do to improve your health? So it dials it in. It removes the error. It removes the interpretation. It provides the value. So it gives you, let's say it gives you a value of 232, and I won't give you the units, but there are units to it. It kind of helps expose part of what we're doing. 232, and now you get a treatment and it's 191. What does that tell you? It tells you the treatment's had an effect. Here's something. With the breast imaging that we've done, we have done several women, one in particular that we've put in the literature, that we've watched her cancer grow. We watched it grow because she didn't want chemotherapy. The physician that we referred her to said, I'm not going to do surgery on you if you're not going to get chemotherapy. She'd had cancer before. She didn't want chemotherapy before. So he refused to treat her. So I sent her to another, one of the top surgeons in the United States, Dr. William Dooley out of Oklahoma University. And Dr. Dooley did surgery and removed the cancer. And we then did follow-up images on her. And here's the interesting thing that we saw. The cancer was in her right breast originally, but we imaged both breasts, the right breast and the left breast. Over the course of time, as the cancer in the right breast got bigger and the counts went up, the counts in the left breast decreased. Mm-hmm. Not on all of the breast, but in just some of the breast. When the cancer was taken out and we followed her up over time, the counts in the left breast increased and eventually became cancer. The primary cancers are larger than the smaller cancers. And cancers release stimulators to stimulate their change, which goes into a longer theory than we have for this program. And they have inhibitors that do the exact opposite. But the stimulators have more effect on the big cancer. But the inhibitors go throughout the bloodstream, and the theory is that it inhibits the smaller cancers. Remove the big cancer, and the inhibitors are gone, and now the smaller cancers can expose themselves. And what did we see in this woman? The normal area on her left breast did not change. Those areas did not change because they were normal. But the cancers that were smaller were being inhibited by the inhibitors, and their numbers came down. So we could track. We didn't know it at the time. This is retrospect. Look what we have learned. The yet undeclared cancer in the left breast was being inhibited. Take away the primary cancer, and it became a new, was it a primary cancer? Was it a secondary cancer? What it was a cancer that was inhibited by the first one, which tells us we can also track changes that might have, visually, you couldn't tell it, but the numbers showed us there was inhibition going on there. Mm-hmm. That tells you you've got something to market and to follow in your treatment of the patient. The other thing it tells us is that primary cancer holds the key to treating cancers because it was treating the other cancer. Only discoverable because of this ability to use this patent to quantify these changes.
So I want to ask about, it's been reported that by the time a woman can feel, or a man can feel a lump in their breast, you know, it's probably been there for about 10 years. You know, that cancer doesn't develop overnight, much like heart disease is not going to develop overnight. Right. So can you tell me maybe at what, because you talked about being on the spectrum and how you kind of have different levels, what stage, not stage, because that's the official word, but maybe what level of disease that you may be in. So how does your method, how soon can it pick up, for example, a breast cancer? And then kind of what's that lead time? If we were looking for 10 years on, you know, radiography, mammography, how much time are you saving there with your method?
Right. Those are good questions. And the honest answer is we don't know. Okay. So I always try to give you that honest answer first, even though sometimes it takes the wind out of the sails. Here's what we do know. There's probably a new cancer cell developing in all three of our bodies today, but it will be taken care of by our normal immune process. We really don't know how long it takes for these cancers to grow because it's speculated, and that's the key word, that, you know, they probably have been growing for 10 years before they're big enough to see. One of the fascinating things that we just learned from this information we sent is that we can track these growth rate changes in the tissue. So we can find the precancerous tissues that aren't normal. They're not normal, but they're not cancer yet either, right? Because cancer, by definition, we've always had this on-off light switch response, right? Well, what is cancer? And some of the papers we've written this year has been that. Well, cancer is the interaction between your specific genome, the genetics in your cells, and the environment surrounding those cells. And that environment's, yes, the air you breathe and it's the food you eat, but more importantly, it's how all that stuff gets to immediately surrounding your cells and how those two factors interact. So your response to something is unique to you. Your genetics and my genetics are not the same, okay? But we can see how these changes occur by this quantification. We can measure these early changes. And one of the things I will give a little breakaway, that one of the things that the cardiologist was not able to do, because when we asked them to do certain things, they just kind of did a big region of interest, which loses some of the information. When you draw very tight regions of interest on breast tissue or heart tissue, you not only see the counts, but you see the spread of these measurements. And it's the spread of these measurements that actually tells you how rapidly this change is occurring. So it is a combination of not only that number, remember I gave you that arbitrary number 242 or whatever it was. It's not only the 242 number that's key, it's the spread, it's the standard deviation or the variance of all the numbers, because that tells you how rapidly the tissue is in the process of changing. So it gives us attention to, well, wait a minute, this is in the inflammatory change, but these numbers are tight. there's not a lot of variability here. So this is not as alarming as, wait a minute, a year ago this number was 180, now it's 242, and the numbers have this widespread. This is something that's changing right now, right in front of us, and we don't have 6 months to 12 months to figure this out. We need to jump on this now. It also provides us the beauty of interacting sooner. What if you have these early changes of breast disease, and there's somebody who says your diet and your lifestyle plays a role? Well, we're not talking about chemotherapy. We're not talking about surgery. We're not talking about radiation therapy. We're talking about, okay, Cheryl, let's see what changing your diet to this does for you. Maybe we can knock it down, because we have done studies where we've looked at, for example, soy protein on women in these inflammatory changes. And for most women, there was an improvement. But you know how the literature sometimes says maybe it's good for you, maybe it's not? Well, there's a reason for that. It's not because the people publishing the papers are nuts, although they might be. I don't know personally. But what we have seen is that for many women with soy protein, their breast health improved. Notice I didn't say breast disease. Breast health improved. For some women, however, their breast health got worse. Now, there are probably very specific reasons for that, whether it's estrogen receptors or progesterone receptors, or specific P genetic receptors that are going on. Again, everybody's different. Even theoretically, knowing whether you should or should not have a response is not nearly the same thing as being able to measure that response and know. So knowing is more important than guessing. You know, a good friend of mine, Henry Lynch, who passed away earlier this year, who came up with Lynch syndrome and talked about BRCA1 and 2. Henry was bald, but if Henry hadn't been bald, he would have pulled his hair out from all the frustration he had because of all the women who have, you know, mastectomies, bilateral prophylactic mastectomies, because they think that reduces the risk of breast cancer. It doesn't, because they still have breast tissue when everything's said and done. Dusty, referring back to what you said about dense breasts and breast implants, we've done this with dense breasts and breast implants. It's not affected because a breast implant doesn't take up the isotope. Yeah. It's not real. It's not living, right? Mm-hmm. And dense breasts are just dense. They're fibrous tissue. So when you measure the counts, they measure like fibrous tissue. They don't measure like breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So they show up. Their measurements are different. Mm-hmm. What may, you know, and I've sometimes referred to this of looking for Jekyll and Hyde in the dark in London on a foggy night, you know, which is kind of what mammography and the qualitative approaches are. We're kind of looking in the dark. Is there somebody out there? Well, this is kind of like taking the lights and shining the flashlights on. Is that Mr. Jekyll, Dr. Jekyll, or Mr. Hyde? Oh, it's Mr. Hyde, but behind Mr. Hyde is Dr. Jekyll. So you can see the cancer in the dense breast, or if it's not there, there's no cancer. It won't measure that way. The cameras aren't fooled. We simply haven't. And I want to thank everybody for the people who didn't go out there and quantitatively calibrate the cameras in advance. Thank you. Otherwise, this patent might not have been possible. and for the other work, you know, but, you know, and it's just the beginning of how we're expanding on that. We are literally on the beginning of this. 3 years ago, you probably saw only the four or five papers that I had published on this that were published with the initial stuff and initially presented at the S&M conferences in Toronto back in the early 2000s. Now, in this last year, I think there's probably 40 to 50 papers we published in the last 2.5 to 3 years. And I've gone to many S&M and many nuclear medicine conferences, and I've gone to ASNIC conferences. And, you know, it's beginning to crack. The people are, you know, we've gone through the period where people have ignored it and said it's wrong to, well, you know, it looks like maybe this is right. Now we're getting some people that are going, well, of course this is right. It's kind of like system maybe redistribution. You know, 10, 15 years ago, I used to talk about system maybe redistribution and people would tell me I'm nuts. Now I go to conferences and people go, well, of course it redistributes. We know that. You know, we just didn't know when to look for it. And to see that, you have to look right away at 5 minutes. You can't wait an hour to see it. So on that one, thank you, Yale and Cedars-Sinai and Hopkins and everybody else for confirming that and you're in studies that have since come out since, you know, I started beating this to death, you know. I think that answered your question, and now I'm doing my professor moment where I forgot what we were doing.
Well, I'm going to let Dusty come up with one last NukeMed question as we wrap this up. I have lots more questions. We could probably do a whole other show because I really want to get into that five-year survival rate thing. How you measure, Dusty mentioned PET earlier on, you know, treatment follow-up and how they, you know, kind of track progression. So I would really, really love to dig into how you see what treatments are working, what does that look like, how do you change, what are your options there? But, we only have so much time for this one show, which gives us a great opportunity to do this again. So I'm going to give Dusty the very last go here to ask one last NukeMed question before we wrap this up.
My last question, I guess, you know, I would like to go back a little bit to the cardiac side, since that is probably the largest percentage of studies that we perform in nuclear medicine. Right. So I would like to know what you think about your algorithms and being able to use them on a daily basis for everyone. What do you think the possibility of that is going to be? What do you see the growth being? Is this currently available for the general public to be able to pursue?
It is available in the sense that we're ready to license it. It's the question about where we're bringing it out. I'm being very particular about where we go for these centers because these centers have to demonstrate excellence. I'm going to divert briefly. When I was a first-year cardiology fellow, some of the research we did were phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors for heart failure. And so the first textbook chapter I wrote in cardiology was on heart failure and all these different drugs that were available. And I cautioned people that we were doing it very well because we were following the rules and paying attention to what needed to be done. And so we had a lot of people in heart failure, class 3, class 4, who could barely breathe just sitting, you know, talking like we are now, that we had to remove from those drugs because unfortunately everybody and their uncle as a cardiologist started using these drugs, but they weren't following the details that we told them to in the papers that we were writing. And so the federal government had to interfere in a way too, and by pulling these drugs off the market, because when the patients would come in and say, Dr. Fleming, you know, but there's no harm for me with this drug. You've been watching what you've been doing with it. And now I can have a conversation with my wife or my husband. And I would go, you know, I get that, but I don't look at an orange. And, you know, so I can't give you this. So we're being very careful on who we do this. So anybody who wants to do it is more than welcome to contact me for this. We are looking for the sites. All three of the ones we have right now, West Coast, Central US, and East Coast, are all three university centers where I've been talking with them and making sure that they know exactly what they're doing. And then we're beginning this process of letting other people know about it. But I'm going to be very, very particular about this because this has my name on it and this has everybody's name on it to do this right. And I want to make sure that the people that are doing this are A, qualified to do it, and B, as concerned about providing the quality care that I am, that they should be. And so this is something we want to be done right from the beginning. So places that are top notch are the ones that we're looking for first for bringing this out, and they will clearly have an advantage. And I've told people that I will probably not even license this to more than one place per city to begin with, because I want, you know, it's our obligation to provide quality medical care. And I almost feel like things have run amok at this point in time where everybody wants to say, well, we can do this test. Come here and get it done. No. if you're going to be somebody who does this test, the patient needs to know that you've been vetted, that you have demonstrated that you are going to provide it, so that when they go to these places, they know that the qualitative control and the quantitative control that's necessary has been done, and that when that doctor looks at them and says, this is your result, it's because they have followed the rules. FYI, this works on all of these camera systems, and because it will use a pixel by pixel comparison for heart disease, it means we can find subendocardial disease while there's only subendocardial and not epicardial disease, and that's where coronary artery disease first shows itself.
Very exciting.
As excited about getting tons of places to do this. I want the best places to do this.
And that's what patients should, demand.
I'm sorry?
Will this be something that I get to add to my curriculum soon?
If the people at where you're at are one of the places that approach me and say we want to talk about it and they're vetted, then yes, it is available.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both, and I absolutely want to do this again because I think we have so much information that we still cover, and I think this is going to be a very important topic for all of our viewers and listeners. Not only that, it's something that will spark so much conversation about treatment, about diagnosis, about the way things have always been done, and maybe how they, you know, how we can evolve into something that's a much better option. So I thank you both a whole bunch, and I can't wait till we get back together again.
Thank you. Looking forward to it. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.